The headlines: Iran says Afghanistan deserves more international attention as China hosts a meeting of Afghan neighbors. Palestinian resistance groups hail an anti-Israeli operation in a Tel Aviv suburb, calling it a legitimate response to crimes against Palestinians. And also, COVID restrictions expanding in Shanghai as new daily cases in China's most populous city jump by a third. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story: just ahead of a meeting Afghan neighbors hosted by China, Iran's foreign minister says Afghanistan deserves more attention from the international community. Hossein Amir Abdollahian says that Tehran and Beijing support independence, national unity, and the rights of the Afghan people. According to the minister, Iran and China are hoping to see a stable and developed Afghanistan that interacts with its neighbors. Amir Abdollahian is set to meet with his counterparts from Russia, Indonesia, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan, as well as the Uzbek foreign minister and prime minister during his visit to China. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi will host the third foreign ministers' meeting of Afghanistan's neighboring countries in Tunji in the eastern Anhui province. Iran's deputy UN ambassador says Washington's inhumane unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic keep seriously threatening the Iranian people's health. In an address to the UN General Assembly, Zahra Ershadi said the coercive measures by the U.S. and its allies make it harder for coronavirus-stricken nations to battle the pandemic. She said the White House claims the sanctions do not hamper Iranian imports of foodstuff and medicine, but the banking restrictions make Iran's purchase impossible. Ershadi also said, despite the sanctions, Iran has made great progress in the medical field and is now one of the few countries producing the COVID-19 vaccine. Resistance movements are heaping their praises on a young Palestinian man who lost his life after killing several Israelis in an operation near Tel Aviv as part of the struggle against occupation. Hamas says the attack was a heroic operation in response to the crimes and acts of terror committed by the Israeli regime, and the Islamic jihadists described it as the price the Israeli regime must pay for its brutalities and terrorist acts. Meanwhile, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has pointed to the operation as proof of a collective Palestinian commitment to resistance. The Al-Aqsa Brigades has also reacted by calling the attack a natural response to Israeli crimes. The 26-year-old Palestinian shot and killed at least five Israelis, including a military officer, in the suburbs of Tel Aviv and was fatally shot by Israeli forces late on Tuesday. Russia's defense minister says that Moscow is now focusing on the liberation of Ukraine's Donbass region as Ukraine's military capacity has been seriously degraded.
The main objectives of the first phase of the operation have largely been achieved. Combat potential of the Ukrainian armed forces has been substantially degraded, thus allowing us to focus our main attention and main efforts on achieving the primary goal of liberating Donbass.
Speaking to officials in a televised meeting, Sergei Shoigu said Russia is monitoring statements by the NATO countries that are after supplying aircraft and air defense systems to Ukraine. He warned that Moscow would respond appropriately if NATO goes ahead with its decision to give more backing to Kiev. Shoigu also cautioned that the Western supply of lethal weapons to Ukraine may backfire on the Europeans themselves.
We consider the position of the West, which supplies lethal weapons to Ukraine, to be irresponsible. Its uncontrolled distribution to the population and mercenaries only exacerbates and may create a threat to the Europeans themselves.
Russia says its cruise missiles destroyed a fuel depot in western Ukraine. According to Ukrainian sources, a Russian rocket hit an administration building in the south, killing 12 people. Meanwhile, Russian media say a military camp of the Russian forces near Ukraine's border has been shelled. Elsewhere, France says, given the circumstances, a humanitarian operation in Ukraine's besieged city of Mariupol remains unlikely. This after a phone conversation between President Emmanuel Macron and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, where the Russian leaders said the Ukrainian nationalists in the city must first lay down arms to resolve the difficult humanitarian situation. A group of leaders of Canadian Indigenous communities have held their second meeting with Pope Francis, the head of the Catholic Church in Vatican City. The meeting centered on a scandal that's been engulfing the church, some of whose members were involved in abusing young Native Canadians at boarding schools. Our correspondent Max Chivili has had an exclusive interview with one of the members of the Canadian delegation who explains how the students were mentally, physically, and sexually abused for more than a century.
In addition to, you know, very strict punishment regimes and all of those things, add to that far too often cases of incredible mental, physical, and sexual abuse of children that went on for decades, for a century, over a century, and it went on in multiple generations in our communities, right? And so the lasting intergenerational impact of that is... it's overwhelming. It really is. It's overwhelming, and it is, it's in many ways immeasurable. But the Catholic Church was not the only church that operated schools, the Anglicans, the Methodists, I believe. But all of the other churches in the United Church of Canada, they've all apologized. The Catholic Church hasn't. And so that's the difference, right? Certain individual religious orders have, but from the institution as a whole, there has been no apology. I would add, though, one thing. From the lead-off, we talked about that there were 140 schools. That's not correct. There were many, many, many more schools. There are 140 schools that are recognized as part of the settlement agreement, which was the lawyers for the various churches and the Canadian federal government who decided that only schools that were operated by the church and exclusively funded by the Canadian government would be eligible. If a school was funded by a provincial government or funded by the church who did fundraising on their own, those were excluded. The same abuse, the same cultural destruction, all those things, but I think it's really important, particularly from a Métis perspective, that we acknowledge that the settlement agreement completely excluded Métis survivors, because it excluded all the Métis schools because they were paid for by the provinces. I personally just refer to it as it was genocide. That was it. What we need is we need Canadians, right? We need Canadians, not Indigenous peoples, but Canadians, to hold their churches, to hold their governments accountable. And, you know, for the continued silence from the Pope, it leaves the impression that, you know, by not saying sorry, you're simply that says something, and by not saying something, it says something, right? And your silence is deafening, I would say. And so I think that is incredibly important that they issue that.
France's upcoming presidential election hasn't generated much interest abroad, but more importantly, not domestically either. The record disinterest renders polls far less reliable and makes 2022 the most unpredictable election in France in recent memory. Rami Mazuri has more from Paris.
France's presidential campaign is officially underway, but many are warning that an election campaign which has been unlike any other could produce totally unexpected results. 10 years ago, it was considered unthinkable that a campaign could be dominated by open Islamophobia, but that's what has occurred in 2022. The lack of serious issues has turned off voters in record numbers. Abstention is now expected to surpass the level set in the 2002 vote, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it into the second round.
I'm not voting because I don't like any of these candidates. If Marine Le Pen makes it to the second round, then I guess I'll be forced to vote to stop her. But this election is just not interesting.
The lack of certainty about how many will actually go vote reduces the reliability of polls. Emmanuel Macron looks certain to make it to the second round, but if left-wing voters do not abstain or cast blank ballots in a common protest vote, Macron could be surprised to face the left's Jean-Luc Mélenchon. The French left is ignored by foreign media and has been left out of the far-right xenophobia of the previous months.
I'm still hesitating a lot, and I'm a leftist voter. Every part of the spectrum is divided, but the left is divided very badly. This means none of the leftist candidates have enough votes to win, so we have to vote for Mélenchon, for a leftist win, and many aren't sure that they want to do that.
In addition to abstention is another issue, a record number of voters who still aren't sure who they'll vote for. It's not hyperbole to say that this is the most unpredictable election in recent memory. A whopping 40% of people who are planning to vote remain undecided. That number is normally around just 25%.
I am undecided. I know that I'll vote, because I always do, but right now, I don't know for who. I just don't really believe any of them.
French polling agencies are not just owned by politicians, they are staffed by ex-politicians at the highest levels. That's made them so not credible, the nation's largest newspaper has refused to run any election polls. The first round vote is on April 10th, and the final round is 2 weeks later. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
China's biggest city and financial hub, Shanghai, locks down millions of people as the city records some of the highest numbers of daily COVID cases since the pandemic began. Home to 26 million people, the city has logged more than 300 new cases, and now it's going through a two-phase lockdown. While residents in the east have been locked down since Monday, those in the west are scheduled to start a four-day lockdown on Friday. Public transport is suspended, and authorities have begun disinfecting places such as office buildings and schools. Over 9 million people have been tested since Monday. China is experiencing its worst outbreak in 2 years, despite adhering to a zero COVID strategy. There have been over 1,600 infections in the past 24 hours. Well, one of the challenges of the COVID pandemic is the risk it poses to the future of millions of children by disrupting their education. The UN Children's Fund says COVID restrictions have led to the closure of schools affecting more than 400 million pupils across two dozen countries. The UNICEF estimates that 147 million children have missed at least half of their in-person schooling. According to its executive director, Catherine Russell, most of those who have dropped out of school risk becoming vulnerable to exploitation. She warns that female students are also getting moved into early marriage as a result of not attending school. In March 2020, 150 countries around the world completely shut down their schools for months. Dozens more partially closed their schools, forcing the students to study from home. The All India Muslim Personnel Law Board has moved to the country's top court, challenging the earlier verdict of the Karnataka High Court, which called hijab a non-essential religious practice. As Munawwar Zaman reports, the Muslim Law Board, in its petition, says the judgment curtails religious freedom and constitutional rights of Muslim girls and women.
Mubina, a young Islamic scholar, says this is incredible. Now Muslim girls and women are being intimidated in India just because of what they want to wear. She says India is a country of diversity and that makes it unique, but she's worried, saying things are going in the wrong direction and this could threaten the very plural nature of the world's largest democracy. The All India Muslim Personal Law Board has now filed a petition challenging the verdict of the Southern Karnataka Court decision upholding the ban on wearing hijab in educational institutions, stating it deprives the constitutional rights of Muslim girls to practice hijab along with the school uniform and curtails religious freedom and constitutional rights of Muslim girls and women.
If our Hindu sisters are wearing sari and sindoor on their head, and Sikh sisters are wearing turbans and carrying kripans, why would they pick the issue of hijab? Tomorrow, they will have issues with skull cap and beard. We have faith in the Supreme Court of our country. They will hear the plea soon and the judgment will be in our favor, since hijab is a fundamental and constitutional right.
In recent months, the hijab controversy gained momentum across the country, sparking debates if the secular fabric is being compromised. The issue galvanized the public sentiment, with people of all faiths questioning religious freedom and equality in the world's most diversified country. Ban on Islamic headscarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the Constitution guarantees them. Some girls now fear they would have to choose either education or hijab.
For me, if it's banned, I won't continue my education. The reason is very simple. It's not just a protective layer. For me, it's my flesh, and you can't attack my flesh. You can't tell me remove your flesh and then come to college or whatever it is.
Observers say this is yet another way of marginalizing the Muslim community, which accounts for about 14% of the overall population. They say efforts are underway to erase Muslims from public spaces and impose apartheid. Earlier, it would be the Muslim azan, what they eat, their marriages and personal laws. Now it's about how they dress.
Critics accuse the ruling party of Prime Minister Modi of further marginalizing the Muslim community. The country's largest Muslim community also shares the same opinion, saying it's a larger political agenda of transforming India into a supremacist Hindu state. They say the ruling party might rewrite the constitution to suit its agendas. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
North Korea has promised to build up its military force as the U.S. levies more sanctions against Pyongyang over its missile and nuclear programs. Meanwhile, South Korean President-elect Yoon Suk-yeol has promised to bolster Seoul's missile systems and strengthen the U.S.-South Korean alliance as experts warn of increased tension on the Korean Peninsula. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
North Korea this week vowed to develop a, quote, powerful strike means free from any threat following its launch last week of an intercontinental ballistic missile, Pyongyang's first such test in 4 years. The country's leader, Kim Jong-un, has said the new striking capabilities are meant to prevent a war, guarantee the security of the country, and contain and put under control all threats and blackmails by the imperialists. With North Korea further confirming its ability to strike the U.S. mainland, Washington was quick to call on other countries to enforce sanctions against Pyongyang. The UNSC, however, appears unlikely to follow U.S. wishes and apply further resolutions against North Korea, with China and Russia calling on the U.S. to consider easing sanctions and seeking dialogue. Meanwhile, in South Korea, a new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, will be inaugurated in May, with experts suggesting his hard line will increase regional tension.
I believe the U.S.-South Korea alliance will be the best in its history, while North Korea's nuclear power becomes more advanced, creating a worrisome situation of more tension on the Korean Peninsula. Another point of concern would be the formation of a new Cold War structure of South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, versus North Korea, China, and Russia.
South Korea's military capabilities have also grown recently, with the president-elect calling for deployment of more advanced defensive and offensive missiles. In response to North Korea's recent missile tests, the Japanese, American, and South Korean military chiefs will meet later this week in Hawaii. South Korean president-elect Yoon Suk-yeol also intends to strengthen ties with the U.S., with his office set to send a 7-member delegation to Washington early in April. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In the United States, a federal judge has declared the actions taken by former President Donald J. Trump and a lawyer John Eastman after Mr. Trump's election loss amounted to a coup in search of a legal theory. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater, Alan Feuer, and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Federal Judge Finds Trump Most Likely Committed Crimes Over 2020 Election. Federal judge ruled on Monday, 28th of March, that former President Donald J. Trump and a lawyer, John Eastman, who had advised him on how to overturn the 2020 election, most likely had committed felonies, including obstructing the work of Congress and conspiring to defraud the United States. The judge's comments in the civil case of the lawyer, John Eastman, marked a significant breakthrough for the House committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. The committee, which is weighing making a criminal referral to the U.S. Justice Department, had used a filing in the case to lay out the crimes it believed Donald Trump might have committed. Donald Trump has not been charged with any crime as yet, and the judge's ruling had no immediate practical legal effect on him. But it essentially ratified the House Committee's argument that Mr. Trump's efforts to block Congress from certifying Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s Electoral College victory could well rise to the level of a criminal conspiracy. The illegality of the plan was obvious, wrote Judge David Carter of the Central District of California. Judge David Carter added, Our nation was founded on the peaceful transition of power, epitomized by George Washington laying down his sword to make way for democratic elections. Ignoring this history, President Donald Trump vigorously campaigned for the vice president to single-handedly determine the results of the 2020 presidential election. The actions taken by Donald Trump and John Eastman, Judge Carter found, amounted to a coup in search of a legal theory. The judge's ruling came as the committee was barreling ahead with its investigation. This week alone, people familiar with the investigation said the panel has lined up testimony from four top Trump White House officials, including Jared Kushner, the former president's son-in-law and advisor, whose interview was scheduled for Thursday, 31st of March. The committee also voted 9-0 on Monday night to recommend criminal contempt of Congress charges against two other allies of Donald Trump, Peter Navarro, a former White House advisor, and Dan Scavino, a former deputy chief of staff, for their participation in efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election and their subsequent refusal to comply with the panel's subpoenas. The matter now moves to the Rules Committee, then the full House. If it passes in the House, the Justice Department will decide whether to charge the men. A contempt of Congress charge carries a penalty of up to a year in prison. But Judge Carter's decision was perhaps the investigation's biggest development to date, suggesting its investigators have built a case strong enough to convince a federal judge of Donald Trump's culpability and laying out a roadmap for a potential criminal referral. Judge David Carter's decision came in an order for John Eastman, a conservative lawyer who had written a memo that members of both parties have likened to a blueprint for a coup, to turn over more than 100 emails to the House committee. A lawyer for Mr. Eastman said in a statement on Monday, 28th of March, that he respectfully disagrees with Judge Carter's findings, but would comply with the order to turn over the documents. In a statement hailing the judge's decision, the chairman of the House Committee, Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, and its vice chair, Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, said the nation must not allow what happened on 6th of January 2021 to be minimized and cannot accept as normal these threats to our democracy. Donald Trump made no public statement about the ruling. Many of the documents the committee will now receive relate to a legal strategy proposed by John Eastman to pressure Vice President Mike Pence not to certify electors from several key swing states when Congress convened on 6th of January 2021. The true animating force behind these emails was advancing a political strategy to persuade Vice President Mike Pence to take unilateral action on 6th of January, Judge David Carter wrote. One of the documents, according to the ruling, is an email containing the draft of a memo written for another one of Donald Trump's lawyers, Rudolph Giuliani, recommending that Mike Pence reject electors from contested states. This may have been the first time members of President Trump's team transformed a legal interpretation of the Electoral Count Act into a day-to-day plan of action, Judge David Carter wrote. Mr. Eastman had filed lawsuit against the panel, trying to persuade the judge to block the committee's subpoena for documents in his possession. As part of the lawsuit, John Eastman sought to shield from release documents he said were covered by attorney-client privilege. In response, the committee argued, under a legal theory known as the crime-fraud exception, that the privilege did not cover information conveyed from a client to a lawyer if it was part of a furthering or concealing a crime. The panel said its investigators had accumulated evidence demonstrating that Donald Trump, John Eastman, and other allies could be charged with criminal violations, including obstruction of official proceedings of Congress and a conspiracy to defraud the American people. Judge David Carter, who was nominated by President Bill Clinton, agreed, writing that he believed it was likely that the men not only had conspired to defraud the United States, but dishonestly conspired to obstruct the joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021. Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history, the judge wrote. In deciding that Donald Trump and John Eastman had more likely than not broken the law, the legal standard for determining whether Mr. Eastman could claim attorney-client privilege, Judge Carter noted that the former president had facilitated two meetings in the days before 6th of January that were explicitly tied to persuading Vice President Mike Pence to disrupt the joint session of Congress. At the first meeting on 4th of January, Mr. Trump and Mr. Eastman invited Mike Pence and two of his top aides, Greg Jacob and Mark Short, to the Oval Office. There, Judge David Carter wrote, John Eastman presented his plan to Vice President Mike Pence, focusing on either rejecting electors or delaying the count. That meeting was followed by another, Judge Carter wrote, on 5th of January, during which John Eastman sought again to persuade Greg Jacob to go along with the scheme. Donald Trump continued to pressure Mike Pence even on 6th of January, Judge Carter wrote, noting that the former president had made several last-minute appeals to Mike Pence on Twitter. Donald Trump called Mike Pence by phone, Judge Carter wrote, and once again urged him to make the call and enact the plan. While the House Committee has no authority to directly bring charges against Donald Trump, and Trump was not a party to the Eastman civil case, Judge David Carter's ruling on Monday underscored the persistent questions of whether Donald Trump could face criminal culpability for both his business dealings and his effort to reverse the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. Last week, the New York Times reported that a pre-prosecutor in New York City who was investigating Mr. Trump's financial dealings believed the former president was guilty of numerous felonies in how he handled his real estate and business transaction before taking office. The assessment of Mr. Trump by the prosecutor, Mark Pomerantz, came in a letter last month in which Mr. Pomerantz announced he was resigning from the Manhattan District Attorney's office, which had stopped pursuing an indictment of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is also facing investigation from the district attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, who recently convened a special grand jury to help probe the former president's attempts to overturn the 2020 election results in Georgia. That inquiry centers on Donald Trump's actions in the 2 months between his election loss and Congress's certification of the election results, including a call he made to Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Secretary of State, to pressure him to find 11,780 votes, the margin by which Mr. Trump lost the state. The House Committee has been seeking to assemble a definitive account of Donald Trump's efforts to hold on to White House and how they led to the assault on the Capitol. Among the documents the committee will now receive from John Eastman is an email that sketched a series of events for the days leading up to the following 6th of January, if Vice President Mike Pence were to delay counting or reject electoral votes, Judge Carter wrote. The email maps out potential Supreme Court lawsuits and the impact of different judicial outcomes, were Mike Pence to enact the plan. The committee will also get documents related to state legislators who were involved in the effort to persuade Mike Pence not to certify some electoral votes. One of them, Judge Carter wrote, is a letter from the Republican members of the Arizona legislature to Mike Pence. Two others are letters from a Georgia state senator to Mr. Trump. The committee has already heard from more than 750 witnesses. John McEntee, the former president's personal chief, testified on Monday. Anthony Ornato, the former White House chief of operations, was scheduled to testify on Tuesday. And Matthew Pottinger, former deputy national security advisor, will do so at a later date, those familiar with the investigation have confirmed. Both Mr. Navarro and Mr. Scavino have argued they are prevented from testifying by Donald Trump's assertions of executive privilege, and that President Biden, who waived executive privilege for both men, does not have the authority to waive executive privilege over the testimony of a former president's senior aide.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Less than 2 weeks remain before elections in France, and anti-government rallies are in full swing. Demonstrators complain about corruption, economic inequality, and political repression, among other issues. After 5 years in office, marred by yellow vest protests, the COVID pandemic, and now the war in Ukraine, Macron is speaking of proposals to cut taxes, generate wealth, and invest heavily to create jobs and raise the retirement age. Okay, now to begin with, let's go to Paris. Our correspondent Rami Nazari has more to tell us on that. Rami, over to you.
Well, it's certainly a French election unlike any other. 15 years ago, and even really 10 years ago, it would be unthinkable that a French election campaign could be based entirely around xenophobia and Islamophobia. It was verboten, taboo to for politicians to talk about these things. But now, here in 2022, that's the honest state of affairs here. That's what the election campaign has been based on, and it has turned off voters in record numbers. I would say that the biggest story here is that there's going to be not just record abstention, probably pushing 30%, but that a record 40% of people are still undecided. That's 40% of people who are planning to vote. So that really puts all of the polls in a very sort of precarious condition, because they are necessarily less reliable if they don't know if people are actually going to vote in the intentions that they are saying. So it's really the most unpredictable election France has had. But I would go back to 2017 when they were talking about a Frexit vote within 6 months, repudiating banker debt. I'd go back to 2012 when they were talking about ending austerity. There was just much more serious issues that were being discussed than in 2022. There is one thing that is sort of very unusual about France, and that's it's considered bad form by politicians to criticize the record of other politicians on the campaign trail. They're supposed to just be talking about the future. So Macron has had economic a failure. He's had the once-in-a-century political repression of the Yellow Vests, but he has really been openly accused of hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. So it makes it doubly difficult to talk about his record. And these are just not the things that the French people want to talk about: Islamophobia, xenophobia, and Ukraine. But here we are, less than 2 weeks to the vote.
All right, thanks for that. Rami Mazari, our correspondent in Paris. Time now to introduce our guests in today's episode of The Spotlight. We'll have Jacques Chaminade, chairman of the Solidarity and Progress Party and former presidential candidate, joining us out of Paris. We'll also be joined by Jeriel O. Coleman, journalist and political analyst, also in Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let me start with Jack. Well, the first question I want to ask you is, you know, more than half the French people do not approve of Mr. Macron's performance. The country is facing a host of issues, as you also heard in the intro. Still, recent opinion polls indicate that Macron is ahead of his rivals. He has 28% in the first round vote. That's what the polls say, followed by far-right Marine Le Pen on 21%. Let's have your take on that.
We are, let's be truthful, we are suffering from an eclipse of democracy, and we have to make the sun shine again to reestablish our political will. Not only 2/3 of the French potential voters have decided to vote, it's only 2/3, 1/3 is are going to abstain, but 2/3 of the voters would not like a new Macron-Le Pen confrontation in the second round, but it's bound to happen. So what's happening? What's happening is that all the political parties involved in the election are bringing some good ideas, some good areas for domestic reform, but none of them meet the challenge of what is needed as a global policy for our country. We are facing a situation of war in Europe and of gas, food, and consumer goods dependency. And this is being reflected in France's in the situation of France, where we are suffering from desindustrialization and abandonment of the agricultural sector and debasement of the middle class. So the established political parties give no answer to that challenge. Macron's policy are liberal, inspired by McKinsey and many other council companies. This is consulting companies. This is privatization and incapacity of the state to guarantee public safety. Other candidates, the extremists Le Pen and Mélenchon, are not capable to ensure the unity of the nation, while socialist and Republican right-wingers have collapsed because of their adaptation to the financial globalization when they were in power. So what's the solution?
Okay, allow us to touch upon other issues later on in the program. Now, let me ask Geroid. You know, some argue that economy, security, and immigration are some of the most important issues besetting France, of course, apart from Ukraine these days. Do you have the same view?
No, not at all. This is a reflection on the war of the cave.
Geroid, please, Jacques.
The challenge is to generate employment for all. And in France, we have good Trumps. We have a tradition of public state sector, and we have a good policy of health and education. But all political parties who have been governing the country have let that collapse. So that's the true issue. The true issue is housing. The true issue is education. The true issue is how we are going to connect a domestic policy with a foreign policy, which will allow us to decide in an independent way what we have to do.
Okay, Geroid, your comments on that.
Yeah, the foreign policy is American foreign policy. France doesn't have a foreign policy and hasn't had a foreign policy since it joined NATO, the commanding center of NATO, and as it's became, it has now essentially become an outpost of U.S. policy in Europe. So on the foreign, geopolitical sense, it has lost any influence, and it is supporting the wrong side in Ukraine. The negotiations there have now moved to Turkey, which I think is reflective of a change of power towards Eurasia, that the Russians see no point in trying to talk to the Europeans because they're not capable of making sense. So I think the foreign policy is coming to an end in the sense that France has had an opportunity in the past to have an independent policy, didn't take that chance, and now is going into the dustbin of history because the nations of Europe are collapsing. If you look at the foreign policy, or the actual just domestic policy, take the colonies, for example, France has lost control of Guadeloupe. It's lost control, it's losing control of Corsica. And Macron is perfectly prepared to cede, to allow independence, I think, in Corsica, because essentially he's working for McKinsey, he's working for private interests, and the whole point of the oligarchy is to maintain global control. So they don't really care if France, the French nation, collapses. If they lose Corsica, they may lose Brittany. And you could see the breakup of the nation state, the oldest nation state in Europe, which would be, of course, a terrible tragedy for France and for everyone. So that's the sort of geopolitical catastrophe. The domestic catastrophe is basically the same story in the sense that you have these lobbies like McKinsey who have been managing the economy and sucking up all the public finance. That's starting to come out now. But I don't think it's going to stop Macron from being re-elected because essentially there's no credible opposition to him. Marine Le Pen is a spent force, a very weak candidate. completely collapsed the last time when she had a chance of beating Macron. Zemmour has no popular support. This is essentially a loser. This guy has lied his way into this position. If you actually look at Macron or Zemmour, he has no coherent policies whatsoever. Okay. This is basically a form of controlled opposition. Right. Similarly with Mélenchon. Mélenchon has been, you know, permanent opposition. He's a permanent oppositionist. He's a Trotskyite. That's his job. He's there to be the permanent opposition, which serves essentially to deviate from the real issues. You know, he's actually a friend of Zemmour. He's close to Zemmour, and he's close to the Arabs as well. So it's a very pessimistic scene. I would call it post-political, in fact. Okay. There's no political content to this election whatsoever.
Let's not touch upon some aspects and some issues more tangibly. Let me ask Jacques, the French people are facing a spike in energy prices. Fuel, we hear, costs more than 2 euros a liter now on average. The inflation rate has been the highest since 2008. So how far is Macron to blame for this?
He is saying that he would deal with it, but he pretends to deal with it within the European Union and NATO. And it's impossible. He can't do that. For France, the challenge is to become mediator, catalyzer, and also inspirer of a new global architecture of development and security to the benefit of all nations of the world. This is a Gaullist policy. And in Europe, it was what, in a way, Chirac proposed in 2006. He said to solve the question of Ukraine, we should recognize the neutrality of Ukraine, assure Ukraine's development, guarantee the borders of Ukraine, both with the Western countries and Russia, and have a security for all of Europe. This is what the Russians are demanding. So the solution could be there in Europe, but it's not going to work as such. And it is now the moment for France to be what De Gaulle on his time said it should be, which is an inspirer of a policy different from that of Wall Street and the City of London, and a policy against all oligarchs, whether it would be British, mainly British, American, even Russians, or French. It is impossible to have this different policy? No, I think. Okay. I'm fully convinced that there is no other way. The alternative being now war or financial collapse of our system. You have all these Americans who pretend to fight and die until the last Ukrainian would die, but not them. And we have these Europeans who said they would fight for Ukraine, but they would leave Ukraine to his fate. So the only way is to have an agreement of all for an economic development to break with the present rules of the game.
Okay, now, Jeroy, there are also worries that the worst is yet to come for France if the Ukraine war drags on, which would push the EU to adopt tougher sanctions against Russia. Is that true?
Yes, I think it is, because, first of all, we must understand that the globalists, the oligarchs in Europe, are ecologically oriented. It's not real ecology, but they're using ecology to change the structure of people's lives and the economic and social structure of European society. So they're pushing the energy transition, and they want to get away from fossil fuels anyway. So many of the green parties all over Europe are quite happy with the energy crisis because they want to stop us using motor cars. So they will use this crisis to further, you know, make people's lives more difficult, because they will encourage people simply to use, you know, bikes to get to work or whatever. But The prices are outrageous now, and it doesn't look like it's going to end unless they get realistic in their dealings with Russia and behave like adults, which of course they don't seem capable of doing. And I think the big problem, like I've said, is this this ubiquitous influence of lobbies, of private corporations, private consultancy firms that are essentially now running the economy. And Macron is the chief persona. He is the personification of that system. Mm-hmm. The Rothschild Bank, the influence of the high finance and the international financial cabal. This is what Macron is essentially about. But he rules through fear. I mean, he's running the country through fear over 2 years. You know, he's also surreally hypocritical. I mean, today he just said that, you know, he opposes violent discourse and violent rhetoric. This is the man who shocked the world a few months ago, you know, when he said he was going to war against a section of his own population.
Right.
So, you know, but I think nonetheless, because he is the only candidate people are used to, and are now you have a society that lives on fear, constant fear in a police state,
right.
Then I think that's what the oligarchs are counting on to keep him in power.
Okay. Now, Jacques, based on polls, close to 30% of the French, one-third of the French, are not willing to go to the ballots in the April election, just like the first round in 2002. I want to ask you how serious this voter apathy could be and what it would mean for election results.
This is a disenchantment of the population because, as I said before, all the ruling political parties have basically done the same policy adaptation to global liberalism. Mm. So, in fact, France has not played its trumps, and now it's the moment to play its trumps. These trumps are nuclear energy, independent nuclear energy, a seat at the Security Council of the United Nations, and a global policy with the public sector. So we have these trumps. We are not playing them. And that's a problem of this election. So that's why people are disenchanted. I think that what we are trying to do on our side is to run candidate elections, trying to promote our views and the views of the Schiller Institute, of the International Schiller Institute, who is calling for this new architecture and meeting all nations to find a solution. In that sense, I think that France, together with China and together with other European countries that may join, and also together with countries like Iran, Argentina, or India, the main countries of the world, including Brazil, these countries should be an alternative in the spirit of the Bandung non-aligned nation and the Colombo non-aligned nations meetings of 1955 and 1976.
Okay.
And I think we should come back to the spirit and the spirit of United Nations. There are very interesting speeches from Wang Yi and Xi Jinping on this direction. We should, France should tell them to keep to their word and we go ahead.
Okay.
And this is the way of the future. And inside the country, we would free for more social and just policies and not just this austerity policy that's falling on our heads.
Right. Now, Giroud, there is another aspect, the French so-called anti-radicalism bill. It's already created an uncomfortable climate for French Muslims. And there are also some experts warning that Paris may be willing to impose this anti-Muslim view on the European Union as a whole. So tell us why Muslims are receiving such treatment in France.
Well, I think that they are the scapegoat.
Yeah.
The whole purpose of these bills really is to stifle dissent. And they usually use the Islamic threat to do that. So if they want to stop parents, for example, from objecting to certain things going on in the school, like certain educational programs that they are morally opposed to, then they, you know, certainly you have an Islamic attack, and it's a hugely mediatized, and then a law is passed against educating your children at home, for example, and that penalizes basically all law-abiding citizens of whatever religious background. So, you know, we have a case here of just blatant hypocrisy, where on the one hand they support countries that send terrorists into other countries like Saudi Arabia, like other Gulf states in the Syrian war, and they've been doing that for a very long time, or they support terrorists now in Ukraine, and at the same time they claim to be in a war against terrorism. I think the Muslim agenda, the anti-Muslim agenda really is much broader than Islam. It's about stifling dissent, and it's a sort of it's something you can pull out of the hat when you need to pass more laws which are restricting people's civil liberties.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this episode of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had Jacques Chaminade, chairman of the Solidarity and Progress Party, a former presidential candidate. Also, Geroido Coleman, journalist and political analyst, joined us from Paris.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام زهدك في راغب فيك نقصان حظ ورغبتك في زاهد فيك ذل نفس.
أمير المؤمنين إمام علي عليه السلام stated, "You're turning away from him who inclines towards you is a loss of your share of advantage, while you're inclining towards him who turns away from you is humiliation for yourself."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So dear friends, in this truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam,